Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily Friend Show. We have an episode with TNT today, that being Tieko and Terence. Tieko, how are you doing?
I'm doing good things, and how are you, Nixon?
I am pretty good, pretty good. And of course, Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, how are you doing, sir?
To quote Pierce Brosnan, die another day, just surviving.
Excellent. Right, let us get into the first story of today, and this is a story we've covered before, but it continues to be a source of incredible amazement, and that is that SCOPA, that's the Standing Committee on Public Accounts, has once again been looking into PRASA, which is the passenger rail agency of South Africa, for the high number of ghost employees that they have been employing and were recently discovered. I think it was towards the end of last year, or maybe a little bit earlier this year, where Fikile Mbalula laid bare the scale of the problem, which is that something around 3,000 employees for PRASA did not in fact exist. They were receiving salaries didn't in fact appear to be any people with who were getting paid for that work. So it was all just money going into someone's pockets. I was particularly amused back when the story first broke a while ago that the way they found out who was a ghost employee was they just took all of the suspected ghost employees, stopped paying their salaries, and waited for someone to complain, which I should say not exactly the most thorough way of investigating the problem. Anyway, Fikile Mbalula, the transport minister, has announced this morning that PRASA has initiated Operation Zivise, or Operation Headhunt, or Headcount rather, which must be completed to identify ghost workers, find the people responsible for stealing the money, because presumably all of these salaries were going into someone's bank account, and the officials responsible must be disciplined. There is also allegations that PRASA has a serious problem with fake ID documents and that the entity was dealing with a serious scam across its entire organizational structure. Mbalula has promised a thorough investigation. Tieko, what do you make of this? I'm just struck by the utter failure in management that this case seems to bring to the fore. I mean, how do you not notice that 3,000 people who are supposed to work there don't work there?
I don't think it's necessarily a matter of not noticing. I think departments are rotten at this point in time, and almost everyone in this department is chowing somewhere. So you have politicians who are chowing your millions and everything at the top there. Then you have state employees who are making plans at whatever level. A cleaner makes sure that they go away with the chemicals for cleaning. Someone who's in HR makes sure that they hire fake people who don't exist so they can chow there. Someone who's in a certain position makes sure that they do 1, 2, 3, or 4, right? So we have a crisis in South Africa whereby everyone, where they are in the government, really, not necessarily everyone, but many of these people in different positions are trying to find areas where they can chow. And in this instance, I think it's not a lack of management, but the managers themselves are probably involved in this. People who should be overseeing and ensuring that these things don't happen. They are the very ones, because it's a space that they find. It's where they can chow. So I think a lot of times we talk about politicians, how corruption in state departments, state-owned entities, and everything of that nature. But we don't really talk about the level at which this corruption has gotten to. From the cleaner, I promise you, to the HR manager, to technicians and everyone. Everyone is literally just finding a way to chow, and this just so happens to be one of those ways. Politicians were not aware of this thing, or they were aware and not paying attention to it, because really they were focused on chowing the huge amounts of money. Now that we have a crisis, the ANC, people are threatening to take it out of power and everything, it's now that they're starting to look into these things. But the reality of the matter is that things are broken in South Africa. It is with disaster and departments. Departments are rotten, from officials to politicians. People are chowing on a daily basis, and that's a crisis that South Africa sits with today, I reckon.
Terence, what do you make of this? How do we move towards a solution? Because I do agree with Tioho that there is, I think, in the public service, some very serious problems with the kind of culture of how people work. There are a couple of people who still try to do their jobs, but it seems that the overall current flows in the direction of just take what you can and get out with as much as you can without adding anything back, which, of course, I think is really toxic. What can we do about this problem?
Well, the obvious solution, given the scale of ghost working, is to get Father Lancaster Merrin from The Exorcist in, because I see no useful alternative. He went through, like, you know, a good couple of movies. But I don't know, we might actually have a worse problem here. I'm old enough, once again, there I go. I'm old enough to remember the 1990s where, I think it was the Limpopo Provincial Administration, they literally made all of their employees stand outside their offices with their ID books in hand so they could go with a clipboard and check that you actually existed. So this is a problem that's now sort of two generations deep. And I think what is particularly shocking about this is that this isn't, you know, sort of garden variety administration. This is a state-owned company which should, and some at some level, work according to some form of market disciplines. Okay, you know, not perhaps as rigorous as your average company, but yes, you are hired to perform a particular job, and if you're not doing that, then your position is superfluous. Now, I'm sure that in any organization, you're going to have a couple of people who either aren't doing anything or maybe don't exist, but 3,000. It just beggars belief. I mean, what's the collective noun for ghosts? A veritable haunting. And I think Tiago is quite right. It's when your problems have asserted themselves at a senior level, like they've done in you know, certainly our larger SOEs. It's very, very simple for people down the line to see what they can get. And in fact, you know, there are people in the civil service who recognize this. I remember when I worked at the Gauteng legislature, going to a sort of legislature training event, and there was one of the senior civil servants, a very, very conscientious sort of good guy who dealt with all parties parties fairly and equally. And he said, you know, every one of you, the employed by a party or by the legislature proper, you have responsibilities to steward the resources properly. It doesn't matter whether you are in charge of a multi-million rand budget or, you know, as you say, your little cart of chemicals. You know, your responsibility is to take care of it prudently. You know, unfortunately, I think that we have a large management cadre that doesn't really think in those terms. It's, you know, that's very big on the big picture issues. You know, how do we transform organizations and write impressive policy briefs or whatever, as opposed to managing the day-to-day the day-to-day functions of things. And I think until we change our minds on that, you know, you can get rid of all the ghost employees you want. You know, it's not fundamentally going to change the problem. I mean, I've heard of crime syndicates insinuating themselves into the civil service. You just list, you know, to pick up salaries that they're not entitled to. It should never have been allowed to get to this point. But like, you know, you pick up that Pazuzu idol in the first edition of The Exorcist, and you know, like 30 years later, you're still having sequels.
Yes, and they get worse each time. Although I've heard good things about The Exorcist 3, so maybe it's a bit unfair. But anyway, that's
I thought the beginning was quite a good one, actually. It was the one set in Kenya.
I think, you know, people often talk about, okay, so a new government comes in, but where's the money going to come from? Because we are in a serious situation now where, you know, the public wage bills are really huge. Government's going to have to do a whole bunch of things to fix problems. Government's going to have to fix inefficiency in the problems. But I think that this story of ghost workers suggests that if a government simply, a new government simply audited a lot of the staff, found out, for example, what everyone does. I know that government departments are filled with various communications officials and liaisons, stakeholder liaisons and people like that. People who it's not entirely clear what they're actually supposed to do. Even if they do show up for work every day, it's not clear that they're doing anything other than drinking coffee and sending WhatsApps on their phone. And I suspect that a lot of government departments would make, have a lot of, shall we say, fat to cut. People who can be let go, can find employment in the private sector, and government could still work just as efficiently, if not more efficiently, without those employees. Tiako, what do you make of that? Do you think I'm being coming up with dreams and wishful thinking?
Not at all. I think you are absolutely accurate, absolutely on point, Nick. I think certainly if you get rid of, if a new administration comes in, audits the employees list, get rid of ghost workers, get rid of some useless positions. I know, for example, here in Polokwane, the Department of Treasury, which is where my father works, in their communication department, I think they have three managers in that department. And when you really listen to what these managers do, their job is really around taking pictures and writing one story or two in a month. It doesn't make sense to have three managers in such a division and all they do is to take pictures and release one or two statements a month. Such positions should be done away with. I remember that particularly the Department of Treasury here in Limpopo, it must have been 3 years ago whereby they had a strategic planning meeting. They were looking into how they can chop off some of these employees who really, some of these positions that they don't really need, right? So you can't immediately get rid of these people, but you can wait for someone to pass away or wait for someone to retire. Then you shut down that position. I don't know where that process is at the moment, but I certainly do think that if at a larger scale such a thing is done, we look at what positions are necessary, which are not, get rid of ghost workers and stuff of that nature, we will at the end of the day have a lower pay bill on the side of the state, and that would be quite assistful for the country and us as citizens, sure.
Definitely. All right, let's move on to our next story, and this is a fairly concerning one coming out of Gauteng, where apparently a written warning has been issued against a whistleblower who blew the whistle on the serious problems in our hospitals. So a pediatrician, a podiatrician who works at the Rahima Musa Mother and Child Hospital in Gauteng, wrote an open letter to the MEC of Health in Gauteng complaining about the horrendous conditions in our public hospitals and how this had contributed to the deaths of some children that were covered in the news. Apparently, this podiatrician then was suspended for a time for transgressing the internal communications policy and public service code of conduct. There was a big outcry amongst other doctors and medical staff, and he was his suspension was lifted. However, he was still given a written warning, which could one day be used in a disciplinary procedure to fire him. So it looks very much as though the government here has just disciplined someone not for not doing their job, but for exposing the problems. Terence, what do you make of this?
Well, that's another perennial evergreen issue. I'm also old enough to remember blah 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 from the 1990s when the Whistleblowing Protected Disclosures Act was being discussed. The ANC was all gung-ho about this because it was going to allow, you know, the people to righteously assert their rights against, you know, abusive monopoly capital that was polluting our rivers and whatever. When the potentials of this to expose, you know, certain other goings on were exposed, all of a sudden the enthusiasm seemed to wane remarkably. I struggle to put into words what this makes me feel. There are some very, you know, there are some very good people in our public health system. You know, I think too often, particularly the middle classes, think that, you know, it's a private hospital or a death trap. Actually, there are centers of excellence, and there are some very good conscientious public sector doctors, probably more than, you know, those who are not. But I think it is out of that impulse, the fact that you actually do care about the health and well-being of your patients, because you've taken a Hippocratic oath, and because you realize that these are not people with huge options as to where they seek treatment, that you do become desperate. See, unfortunately, this has been another casualty of the politicization of the civil service and the prioritization of demographics above everything else. That managing a hospital is not the same as treating a patient. Administration and medical care are different, and managing that sort of system takes expertise that takes years to get hold of. I remember it was about a decade ago, the DA in Parliament made a big issue about this. There was a hospital in the Free State where the manager had a BA in politics or something. You know, no qualifications germane to it, no particular experience. You know, how that qualifies you to deal with the human resources issues and with the ensuring that drugs and pharmaceutical products and whatever are available, I don't know. But I think that what you see here is the sort of knee jerk response. You know, we've been challenged. We got to put this guy in his place. Now, the person bringing these charges can probably point to some letter of the law justification, and perhaps there's merit in that. But surely this is a spirit of the law thing. If you know you're concerned about children with no alternatives being infected with pathogens that they should not be exposed to, you know, makes you a bastard. Well, I'm happy to sign on the bastard dotted line.
Diego, what do you make of the story? I think that, you know, in dealing with corruption, it's become increasingly clear in recent years that whistleblowers are under very serious threat, not just facing disciplinary problems, but also perhaps even being targeted their lives. Of course, we famously see in the case of Babita Deokran, who was murdered after noticing some corruption in public hospitals. What do you make of this?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think that a caring government or politicians who at least care about the lives of children and the lives of citizens would have reacted in a different manner. Perhaps, yes, there are internal laws that the doctor should have followed in bringing about the complaints first internally before going externally. But, I mean, the merits of what he says, that's what should matter to someone who truly cares about the health of the people. What is this person complaining about? Is it true what he's complaining about? How can we best deal with this thing? Those would be the following questions from such people. But quite clearly here, we are dealing with people who don't really care, right? They would rather punish you for raising these issues externally than to say that let's sit down and find a solution to these issues. How do you think we can best address these issues? But more than anything, I think, yeah, you are quite correct. Whistleblowers in South Africa are not protected at all. They are always under attack. And if one is not suspended or fired from a job, one is murdered. Last week, there was a certain incident. It was in the family. I won't go into details with it. But someone who was trying to hold people in the private sector to account was almost murdered in my family. So it's really annoying to be a South African at this point in time. I hope that in future we'll find better ways of dealing with such stuff.
Definitely. All right, let's move on.
If I could just add something there. I remember something over a decade ago, about 2007, 2008, the Deputy Minister of Health at the time was Madlala Routledge, I believe, took umbrage at the way that the state was responding to conditions at the Freer Hospital in the Eastern Cape. And she was effectively kicked out of the cabinet, and it was widely speculated that was the reason she couldn't work as part of a collective, I think was the official explanation. She's a member of the Communist Party, so I think she's pretty, very big on working in collectives. But, you know, I remember that scandal, and I remember that there was some sort of inspection, which I think was carried out by President Mbeki himself. I could be wrong there. Perhaps it was by the minister, the Beetroot one. And, you know, literally they put these pot plants and they cleaned the place and spruced it up. And apparently like a week later, it was back, you know, it was really just for show. It was like props on a movie set. Yeah, you know, and I, you know, for a political party that trumps its commitment to being a servant of the people and, you know, so solidarity over individualism or whatever, this is grotesque. Really?
Yeah. No, I think that's about the shape of it. Let's move overseas for some good news. And this is that the current leader of the terrorist group Al-Qaeda and its formerly its second-in-command, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has apparently been killed in a U.S. drone strike in Kabul in Afghanistan. Al-Zawahiri was a very big figure in the establishment of Al-Qaeda and the and its global operations and its ability to attack targets all over the planet. He was originally a Egyptian doctor who started a terrorist group in Egypt that later merged with Al-Qaeda when he met Osama bin Laden and gave it a lot of the sort of logistical training and manpower resources it really needed to get off the ground. Ever since Osama bin Laden's death in, 2012, he's been a major figure in Al-Qaeda, technically being its leader, although Al-Qaeda is not what it used to be after the many parts of it being destroyed by the U.S. over the two decades long war on terror. Last night, President Joe Biden announced confirmation the Americans had in fact killed him. They killed him a few days ago, but they had refused to announce it publicly because they weren't sure 100% whether they knew it was him that they had killed. They say that there were no civilian casualties in the strike. In fact, it's not even clear that they used an explosive missile. They may have just used a very specific targeted weapon to dispatch him. Apparently, the house in which al-Zawahiri was staying in was owned by a top aide to the senior Taliban leader, Sirajuddin Haqqani, who is one of the most important figures of the Taliban. And so this suggests that there are at least some factions in the Taliban that are once again very close with Al-Qaeda, despite the agreements they signed in Doha, which said that they were supposed to renounce their ties to terrorist groups. It's also possible that this information was given to the United States by another faction of the Taliban who are competing with Haqqani, as the U.S. has confirmed, or it's been confirmed to the Associated Press, that there were apparently zero U.S. personnel in Kabul. The White House, after his killing, said that al-Zawahiri had continued to be a dangerous figure, that he had continued to provide strategic direction, including urging attacks on the U.S. while in hiding, and had prioritized members of the terror network. That al-Qaeda remained the primary enemy of the United States. A statement from the Afghan Taliban government said that the airstrike did in fact happen. They didn't talk about who may have been killed in it. They said, "We strongly condemn this attack and call it a clear violation of the international principles and the Doha Agreement. Such actions are a repetition of the failed experience of the past 20 years and are against the interests of the United States of America, Afghanistan, and the region," the Taliban said. Terence, it kind of feels like, in a sense, I mean, this is one of the other big masterminds behind the 9/11 terrorist attacks, that this is kind of sort of the end of an era, in a sense. Osama bin Laden's dead, and now his second in command is dead.
Well, look, I think we should just point out that we're talking Taliban Afghanistan, not Taliban KwaZulu-Natal.
yes. Very, very different. Yeah. Well, yeah. At least a little bit.
I don't know. I'm not sure how well Taliban KwaZulu-Natal would get on under the gentle sway of the
I suspect Taliban Afghanistan is perhaps a little bit more organized and dangerous.
Yeah, probably. with one of the strongest, best equipped militaries in the developing world, thanks to the courtesy of American Russian withdrawal. Look, I think that there's probably many people in the American Democratic Party who are sort of giggling about this, that, Obama got one and Biden got the other. And I do remember Obama's announcement. It was actually quite masterful. I think that for me, what this demonstrates is the way that these things have kind of progressed and superseded one another. I remember back in the 80s, it was Abu Nidal and whatever. Then, you know, it became Osama bin Laden. Al-Qaeda was the kind of big name, avatar for Islamist terrorism around 9/11. Subsequently, ISIS kind of took over. And while I'm certainly not going to shed any tears over this, quite the contrary, I also think that in a sense, it seems to me that Al-Qaeda is almost, the Al-Qaeda model has almost been exhausted. You know, ISIS came up with this idea, or the ISIS and ISIS affiliates, loose affiliation, small cells, often disconnected from one another, pledging a kind of common ideological allegiance and adapted to local circumstances. So, I mean, you know, you had these ISIS controlled areas in Syria and Iraq where, you know, people weren't austere living sort of religious fanatics, you know, bragging about their, you know, cans of Red Bull and whatever. You know, how you can come here, have a great life and kill infidels in the process. Whereas Al-Qaeda was much more about, you know, we value living in caves. We like death and you like life. So yes, you know, this is in a sense, justice served. But the macro challenge dealing with the type of terrorism that brought down the Twin Towers, I think that remains very much a live issue, and also one that countries perhaps less equipped to deal with it than the United States are having to deal with. And I think that America's, let's say, flexible reliability as a partner in those things, as changeable policies, do not always augur well for countries and for groups that have borne the brunt of this. If you think about the Kurds, for instance, or, you know, I wonder what a government like Kenya might think. You know, does it feel it's being adequately supported in its own efforts, or was this something that was simply pushed, pushed out of the American sphere of influence and out of the American out of the American cultural mainframe now?
And indeed, we've seen Al-Qaeda continues to have a bit of a presence in some places. I know that they have a presence in Yemen. I think they still have some affiliation with Al-Shabaab.
Yeah, well, I see one of our viewers has actually remarked on that. Yes, it's true, and it's a different methodology. But I think my point is that the ISIS or ISIL model is much more effective, and I think much more alluring.
Yes, Tejo, what do you make of this? What are your thoughts?
I think I'd rather not share my thoughts around this. I'd have to take a bit of time to reflect that around the matter. But I do think that Al-Qaeda hasn't been that powerful since 2020, since the death of Osama, in 2011. They haven't really been powerful at all. They've been making threats. But really, that's all they've been doing, making threats, coming up with plans that don't really work and stuff of that nature. I do think that justice has been served. But I wonder, I don't quite know how I feel around the whole thing and how at the end it came down, with the second lead in command being murdered now. But I think, I'd have to take a bit of time around this one. But I think for the most part, I support everything that Terence has said on his part. The most important thing for me being that they really haven't been Their heat hasn't been that felt since 2011. So I just have to, in my own mind, conclude as to what I think my ultimate, how do I say it? My ultimate, do I think that the right thing was done or not? Or could they have just let the men be and nothing would have happened? I think, yeah, that's where I'm still battling with my thoughts.
So I think it may be, you know, with the ability of the US has shown that its ability to sort of kill these senior kind of charismatic figures all over the globe. And of course, during the Trump administration, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who is the leader of ISIS, was also killed in a US raid. I wonder whether the time of the sort of terrorist network headed up by the kind of key charismatic figures is over, and instead they really are going to be more decentralized and focus on local leaders who don't have quite the same international impact. Anyway, we are out of time, so that'll be for another day. I hope you all found the show interesting, and we will, of course, see you tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Just a reminder, there will be no show on Thursday, as we are all going to be attending a funeral. Anyway, thank you very much, everyone. Have a great day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Cheers.